As promised, he's taken time out of his Christmas morning to join us. We appreciate that so much. Keith Hernandez. Keith, how are you this morning? Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, not a problem. I'm just having my coffee, and it's 71 degrees down here. I'm in the cutoff, and it's a beautiful morning. Sorry about that.
Yeah, well, you know, where I am, it's only 56, so it's not too bad. But do you have holiday traditions? I mean, my brother watches Holiday Inn. He watches A Christmas Story. He watches all these movies every year. Are there any movies or any traditions that you do every year, year after year, that go back to your youth?
Not really, but obviously one of my favorites is Christmas Carol. And I particularly love the one where George C. Scott plays Scrooge. So that's kind of my favorite. I think it's a wonderful story. But I'd really, I don't have anything I do annually.
Any music that you look forward to hearing, or is it like, oh, enough of these Christmas carols, because stations play it 24 hours a day?
Yeah, it used to be wonderful when, oh, I haven't heard that song and since I was a kid, and it brought back memories. But again, I think it's just oversaturation. But Christmas morning, I have specific on my iTunes. I guess I'm dating myself. I have specific albums that I love that are Christmas albums. Andy Williams, of course, Johnny Mathis. Oh, gosh, I can't think of the other one that is just terrific. And there's, Bob Dylan has a nice Christmas album, believe it or not. So those are the kind of things I like to listen to.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It used to be every major singer had a Christmas show. It was Bing Crosby with his Christmas, Andy Williams, Bob Hope.
Right.
They all had their Christmas show. Sinatra had a Christmas show for a while. I don't really see that anymore. Singers don't host shows like that. Johnny Cash, guys like that.
Yep. Well, we've kind of gotten away from it, haven't we? And I don't know if that's for the better. I don't think it is. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because I went on YouTube and I watched a couple Andy Williams Christmas specials. I watched a couple Dean Martins over the last week. Dean Martins always puts on a great show. It's more comedic. Bing Crosby's Christmas shows. And things that I watched when I was a kid in the mid-60s, early 60s that bring back how you felt when you were a kid and when Christmas was really, really special, because it's really Christmas is the celebration of Christ, of course, but it's the kids. It's a special time for children.
Did you ever meet any of those guys like the Andy Williams and Bob Hopes of the world? You know, once you attained that certain level of celebrity, did you ever run into any of them?
No, I would have loved to, but no, definitely not. I'm sure if I had played for the Dodgers, I probably would have.
Yeah.
But I was on the other side. I met a lot of people in that industry, up at Elaine's, in the movie industry, in the theater, and music. But nothing as far as, the Christmas entertainers.
Yeah, it's interesting because Ralph Kiner, even though he played for the Pittsburgh Pirates, knew all those Hollywood, right. He dated Hollywood actresses and all that. I wondered if Ralph and you ever shared any stories about those people.
Well, Ralph was very much a class act and did not divulge any information. I always tried to pressure him about his dating when he took Elizabeth Taylor. Evidently, he took her to the Oscars and dated her for a bit. Evidently, he almost, he was engaged to Janet Leigh, he said. And she went off and made a film with Tony Curtis. And
could have been the Vikings, could have been Spartacus, probably the Vikings, I would guess, right?
I'm not sure, she fell in love with him, wound up marrying Tony Curtis.
Wow.
So that was an interesting story, but he wouldn't. I always pressured him on Elizabeth Taylor, and he would never say anything.
Oh, boy. That's tough, you know. That's a class act, because it's hard, you know, because you think, boy, I dated Elizabeth Taylor. People, hey, I dated these people. But no, he was quiet about that.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. Musically, you know, we talked about that. But you know what? Keith and I have been going back and forth a little bit about reading. And I'm just wondering when you started to read. Were you always a kid and reading, or did this come later in life? When did you become such an avid reader?
I remember being so excited in elementary school and early. I don't know if it was first. I mean, kindergarten, we're just little kids. And, you know, I was always the youngest in my class because of my birthday. You know, I graduated from high school when I was 17 instead of 18. But I remember I couldn't wait to go into the library, the school library. And the first book I took out, I had no idea, but it was a book about Egypt. And it was the most dry read. And I was just a little kid and I was trying to read it. It was about archaeology. And so it wasn't a great choice. But I didn't start really getting interested in reading until my brother. My brother and was it fourth grade or was it sixth grade, had Mrs. Todd, who was really an old grouch and not very nice gal. And there were two teachers, and he had her. I mean, he had to read a book a week. So Gary threw books at me when he liked a book, and he would throw books at me. Like, he threw Huckleberry Finn, da-da-da-da-da-da. And that's when I started really, really getting interested in reading, and I've always been a reader.
And through your baseball career, did you read after games, before games, in the afternoon if you're playing a night game? Were you reading throughout that career?
I certainly read in the off season a lot, and I'm trying to think back. I remember my dad saying, "Don't," which was silly, but maybe he had a point. You don't want to read too much before a game, son, because your eyes will get fixed on something in front, and you got to follow the ball out of that pitcher's hand and off the bat. So don't read before too close to a game, which I never did. Whether it was, that's a fact or not, I don't know, but I'm sure my eyes would have readjusted. But, yeah, I did read on the road. There's no question that I did. I've just been a big reader. You know, you're reading the Len Dayton's right now. I read them when I was playing, and I loved the nine books, I guess they are. I couldn't put them down.
Now, you became a big fan of Le Carre and Dayton and the spy novels, and I'm wondering where your interest in those spy novels came from.
Well, I first read, if you remember, the Dean Martin movies, The Silencers, Murderer's Row, mm-hmm. where he played Matt Helm. Now, they were kind of farces, but the books, that's the first book. I never read Mickey Spillane or any of the detective ones, Dashiell Hammett. But for some reason, I guess I grew up in the James Bond. I mean, when Sean Connery came out with James Bond, that kind of took the nation by storm. And I always had a thing for espionage, so I remember the Matt Helms, and I'm reading them when I was younger, you know, a teenager. I was in high school. I read all the Matt Helms. And when I was a kid, I read all, at that point, 52 of the Hardy Boys.
Ah, yeah, yeah. How about Tom Swift?
I could not put the Hardy Boys down.
Did you read Tom Swift?
I did not. To me, it was the Hardy Boys.
Yeah. Yeah. I read both. I read the Hardy Boys and Tom Swift. And Tom Swift, you know, Tasers, Tom Swift's electric, it's a rifle. It's named after Tom Swift. Thomas A. Swift's electric rifle is how Tasers got their name.
Really? So some, interesting.
Yeah. So somebody must have been a big Tom Swift fan who invented Tasers. But, I mean, you know, it's funny. My reading when I was younger, especially in my teens, Harold Robbins. Now, Harold Robbins was kind of like, a little lurid. You know, he'd always have sex scenes in there. And for a kid, it was like, man, this is really interesting. Yep. But he also did Adventurers and Carpetbaggers and stories that had historical significance too, and travel. And that was one of the things I didn't travel, but in reading about Rome and reading about all these exotic places, you know, you could transport yourself to those places by reading books.
Right. And also it also transformed on the silver screen when we went to theaters, and you know, America was, no one traveled like they do today. My parents couldn't afford to get on an airplane and go see a Frank Sinatra in Vegas. They couldn't afford that. You know, my kids, they run around and they travel. My dad couldn't afford to go to Europe. And so when you went to the movie theater, and, you know, Goldfinger comes to mind, when Monte Carlo, you know, you got to see Monte Carlo, when all the various places around the world that were just exotic, and it brought it to life, brought it home. You know, where I was just living in Northern California, we didn't travel much. We went to Disneyland twice when I was a kid in Los Angeles, and that's about the extent of it.
Is there a place that you haven't traveled to that you've, you know, I hate the term bucket list, but one of those places where one of these days I got to get there, in your mind?
I would like to go island hopping down the South Pacific start out in Guam, Hawaii, then shoot on down the Marianas, and then eventually end up New Zealand and Australia. I would love to do that. As far as Europe is concerned, I would see. I've been to Rome, but only for a couple days, and I would like to go back. Been to Edinburgh, been to London, been to Paris. I'd like to go to Vienna. I'd like to go to Prague. There's a lot. I'd like to take that the boat down the Danube all the way to the Black Sea. I think that would be fantastic.
Well, in reading Dayton now, I've got the hots for Berlin. See what Berlin is like, because he describes Berlin, back when the wall was there. And I wonder what it's like today in Hamburg, where they have that model airplane train set thing. I don't know if you've seen that, where they've taken a warehouse and they've got this incredible miniature world, basically, where they have planes taking off and trains going and cars. They even have a red light district. It's just an amazing recreation. I'd like to see that someday.
There's lots of things that the world's a big, wonderful place to go visit. There's a lot of things that I'd like to do, and time's running out. But but usually the summer vacation, and that's why we didn't travel as a family, because we had Little League and all the baseball leagues in the summer. We couldn't, and baseball's been my life, and in summer I'm working.
Yeah, and you continue to do so. Switching over to baseball, I was talking to Rick Cerrone from Baseball Digest before, and we're talking about different things that baseball is trying to do now. And I know you're a traditionalist, but I imagine your hackles were raised a little bit when you heard about this golden at-bat. When it was, we're talking about maybe taking a player and putting him in the ninth inning in a key situation, even if it's not his turn at bat or if he's been taken out of the game. What do you think about changes like that to the fabric of the game?
Well, that's radical. To me, that's one of the most radical things the most. I don't like it. I mean, I remember Tom Seaver talking with me when I was traded over and we were just sitting down. And he said, I used to get to the sixth inning. We were playing the Giants. I'd have to think ahead a couple innings and put it all together. I got to get this guy out so I don't face Mays and McCovey in the ninth inning. Well, that would change that, wouldn't it? Now, granted, there's no starting pitchers anymore that go nine. But I never thought of it that way before. That struck me when Seaver mentioned that to me. Jim Palmer, good friend. We just exchanged. We talked to each other the other day, yesterday, wishing each other Merry Christmas. He used to say, I used to have to go into Boston and be in the seventh inning. I have to figure out how to get through Yastrzemski and George Scott, you know, in the eighth or ninth inning. But, you know, they've taken that away with the starting pitchers not doing complete games anymore. And that's a strategic part of the game. And, you know, and tactical that is gone now.
Well, so, and it seems to me
that has taken away the beauty of the game, too.
Well, it seems to me that they've taken it just like in football. They took the play calling away from the quarterbacks. I wonder if the pitchers of today think strategically in advance, or it's the managers and the pitching coaches who have a script. Well, this is how I see the game going, and I'm going to only let this guy go through two times through the batting order, and then I'll put this guy in because it should be this part of the lineup. It seems that they're taking the thinking away from the player and more toward management, do you think?
Yes, I do. I had a conversation with Boomer once out in Sag Harbor at American Hotel, and the play calling is so complex. When he's with the Jets, Boomer said, I call the plays, and I had to call law. For each play, there was a call. You called for the line setup, line blocking. He said, I tried it for a couple of weeks. Finally, I went to the head coach and said, I can't do this. You guys, it's too much. I've got to have you guys call the plays. So I think there's more intricacies. I think it's too much for the quarterback, too much on his plate. I mean, he can always go up there and call an audible if he sees something. But I think the quarterback has, you know, being an old quarterback myself in high school on a very insignificant level, there's a lot going on in the quarterback in the course of a game that he'd be worried about calling plays. It's difficult. But, yes, I mean, I don't like the pitch comms. I mean, it just, if you're worried about the TV camera, and I think that's where it originates, where we used to always, when Bill Webb was our director, and still with John DeMarsico, the Mets would always moan and groan, don't do the close-up of the pitchers putting their fingers down. You know, you're giving signals to the pitch. Well, you had codes. You know, put down codes. Now, nothing drives me more crazy than when the pitcher goes out there and it's pitch calm and the battery goes dead. It just drives me nuts. They're trying to speed up the game, and here we go. We got dead battery, and it happens a lot. It just drives me nuts. And I remember we played the Cubs, and when 84, when the Cubs beat us. And we knew that veteran team had Larry Boa, Ron Say, Jody Davis. It was a veteran team. And we knew they were stealing signs, but they were stealing them legitimately. If the catcher got lazy back there, or a pitcher, a runner on second base would relay a sign. We did it once in a while if we could do it. You know, you had both hands on your knee and your lead to be a fastball, and you stand up straight to be a breaking ball if you stole the sign from second base. Boa, when we traded for him in 87, I believe, he said he used to get first and second. He used to first baseman playing behind me because I used to get an extra big lead. And if that catcher didn't put his leg when he was in a squat, if he didn't close up his legs enough, I could see the sign and I would relay to this runner on second base. And if there was no one on second base, then I would take in a big lead, and I was able to do it if the catcher was really lazy. I relayed to the hitter. That's all, to me, is fair. All fair in love and war there. Just to make it real, I mean, I know I'm yapping too long here. We were so sensitive about that when we played the Cubs in August and September when they beat us. Carter changed the signs every inning when men got on base. Went out to the mound and changed the whole code. So they couldn't steal our signs. Just do the extra work.
What about pitchers who tip their pitches. Like Severino, before he came to the Mets, that was the rep on him that, he tips his pitches and people know what's coming. He seems to have cleared that up with the Mets because he had a nice season. But were you into observing pitchers very closely and seeing if they were tipping?
I was not, and I wasn't interested. I didn't really get involved until I got traded to the Mets, and Rusty was the master of it, Rusty Staub. And I didn't like to know signs when I was young. But, boy, as I got older, gosh, if I knew a fastball was coming or a breaking ball, shoot, why not? I mean, that's a serious, serious advantage. And I think what's happened now is with all the computer geeks that are part of the organization, you've got guys with the computers that are specifically going over pitchers and looking for tendencies, tip-offs. That's what they're there for. I mean, when we fly in the airplane now, they have an extra big plane, the same amount, five coaches. Well, there's more coaches now. But, there's 26 players instead of 25. You got to have a big old long plane because it's a whole team of analytics people that are on the computer. I don't even know who most of them are. And when we played, it was just, we used to call it fly the old DC-8 in St. Louis on Ozark Airlines. It was a little tiny airplane with the jets in the back tail, the two jets in the back tail. And we fit in nicely. And then when I came to New York, the press flew with us, if you can believe that. The media, the newspaper people flew with us. And there was never a problem. But you had the Daily News, the New York Times, Joe Durso with the Times, Klapitz with the Post, Lupica with the Daily News. They flew with us, which was pretty remarkable.
This day and age, yeah, because they're the enemy now. They'll do things like that. Yeah, I'm curious. The Mets have signed Montas. They've signed some pitchers that aren't exactly household names, that don't have great resumes per se. But last year, Stearns was able to do that. And whether it was the Mets pitching lab or whatever, they took guys who were kind of, had mediocre track records, and they became integral cogs. Manaea, who they just re-signed, they changed his pitching angle, angle.
They didn't change his pitching.
He did.
Remember,
yeah,
he watched that game when he was watching when who won the Cy Young for the Braves, the left-hander.
Yeah,
with
Sale.
Sidearm delivery. Sale. He was. Yeah. He said he was watching, and he said, "I'm going to try that." And he went down and tried that. So that was his observation, and credit to him. Kudos to him watching the game. You watch the game from the bench, you can learn things as the game progresses. And I was told that as a young, in the minor leagues by my managers and all the way through my big league, early big league days. So credit to him. In answer to your question, Stearns, I think, has a really good knack and has good people around. He's a good judge of talent, and they've made good observations. Okay, the only thing that I find funny is, okay, we're rolling the dice here on a guy who's had a couple of bad years, but he had a couple of good years before. He had injuries. We're going to take a chance that you're paying him $10 million. A $10 million gamble. That's the funny thing about it. Where before, okay, you'd pay a guy $50,000, take a chance on. Today, $10 million a year is a bargain.
Yeah, and Burns is out there. Some of the big names were out there, and the Mets supposedly didn't have a whole lot of interest. Now, maybe they're laying in the weeds and they'll jump on them later, but he doesn't seem to go to the top of the pitching market. He tries to go in that middle, and so far, it's worked.
Yes, and we all know that if they need anything now. They made the big splash with Soto. I am hopeful that Pete comes back and doesn't have to feel that he's okay. Well, so-and-so is making this, and like the Christian Walker just signed with Houston for $20 million a year, and he's 34, where Pete's 30. What are you going to pay me? That's one of the things that Marvin Miller did the players never knew what the other player was playing. They were kind of a sworn to secrecy, although I'm sure they yapped under the table to each other. But Marvin made it where it was public what the players were making. So therefore, agents and the player can go, well, you're paying first baseman X this amount of money. He's 34 years old. That's what happened with me with George Foster when I was doing my negotiation with the Mets when I just did the 5-year deal. George was making $10 million in 5 years, and George was five years older than me and hadn't had the years that he had in Cincinnati. And we said, well, if you can have Foster, you're paying him 5 years, $10 million. Well, what am I worth? You're getting me at 30 in my prime years. And that was a negotiating wedge for us.
Well, when I had Cerrone on, we were talking about Soto and Judge. And he said, well, Aaron Judge, if they had signed Soto for $760 and Aaron Judge is making $360, how is Judge going to feel? Because he is the better player. He is the MVP and all that kind of stuff. Do players get jealous like that if somebody signs big, or do they say, hey, the rising tide lifts all boats? How do players react to that when a teammate gets a ton of money like that?
I think there's nothing etched in stone. I think it goes with the individual. Some players would get jealous. And I must say in my day, there was some that were angry and bitter and felt they were underpaid, but they were not. They were the minimum. Wasn't that much around. And it's not like, if you're making $150 million and you feel you should be making $250, you're a multimillionaire. You're set for life. It wasn't like it was in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s before the salaries exploded, where, you had to try to max out on what you made to set up your life after baseball. I mean, you're set with a big contract today. I mean, it's just the money. The money's staggering.
You're set for generations. I love it when players go, I got to take care of my family. I got to take care of my family. And it's like, how many families do you have for $150 million or $200 or whatever you're going to make? Final thing, because I want to let you go. I don't want to take up too much of your time on Christmas morning. But
I'm sitting here. I got all the time in the world.
Oh, well, we'll keep you then. Okay. I was going to ask, in your gut, because I know in you don't know anything inside necessarily, will Pete be back as a Met, do you think?
I think moving Vientos to first base, which has been a talk, is going to be a mistake. He's had a terrific year last year. Let me tell you, he would. Did he hit 30? I'm not sure. I don't think he did. But if he had
26,
played a full year,
he
would have hit like maybe 35 home runs, maybe 32, 33. I want to keep him where he's comfortable. He did play under Buck last year. They put him at first base, and I remember going to Buck. I go, Buck, he's going to get killed over there, and he's going to kill you. And he goes, Keith, he's never played first base. You can't expect anything from him. And I go, well, so I don't know. First base is very technical. Everybody looks at first base, you hide someone. There's a lot of footwork involved. Pete is very good at scooping the ball, and that saves runs. The ball gets by the first baseman and runs down the right field line or rolls into the dugout. Runners are advancing. It's a critical position, and it's often overlooked. And I think it still is today. I think it's a very underappreciated position. It's a critical position. I'm hoping that Pete comes back, because look at the lineup if he's there. When you got Lindor will lead off, look at all. You can have Marte hitting second. You can have Nemo hitting second. Soto third. Pete fourth. Vientos. That is...
Oof.
A pretty good lineup, and I feel that Marte and McNeil are going to have bounce back seasons. I really do. I think McNeil got all wound up. McNeil's—he's the reason why they call him the squirrel. He's squirrely, and first half he didn't handle it well. He played better in the second half. I'm not thinking he's going to be a batting champion again. Maybe he'll prove me wrong, but He's a 300 hitter, 290 hitter, hits in the clutch. I think that year's behind him now. I think he'll build off of that. And I don't think it's going to be that way for him. Marte came off a double groin surgery. He actually stole bases in the second half and during the season. I think he was, you got to be in the back of your mind of, gosh, I've had two groin surgeries, played a little gingerly. It affected his defense a little bit. He's still got a fast bat. I think he's going to have a bounce back year. And this is that lineup that Stearns has put together and that Mendoza used so brilliantly, where you've got a lot of interchangeable parts. You know, you got McNeil in left field, and McNeil doesn't hurt you in right and left. He's a positive, except for his arm, because he's an infielder. You can't expect him to have a good arm. But you can move him, you can move him to second base late, which Mendoza did. Move over, what's his name?
Iglesias?
Move him to third. Terrific glove. You take Vientos out, and you got a great defense. You got a great outfield out there. So defensively, that was a plus for that ball club. So, you know, it's all about dollars and cents. How much is ownership going to be willing to go over the threshold and pay those, you know, the penalty?
Tell you what, Keith, have another cup of coffee, and we'll take a break here, and we'll be right back with more Keith Hernandez on The Fan.
Okay. Very good.
Keith Hernandez is our guest. We've been talking baseball, a lot of other little things as we move on Christmas morning. Keith enjoying the nice weather and his cutoffs and all of that. So, you know, you're looking at the Mets now with that lineup if they sign Pete. So do you think that's it, or do you think the bullpen still needs some attention, another starter? What are you thinking because they're in a tough division. The Phillies and the Braves, you know, are not going to go away easily. And then if they get through that, they've got the Dodgers to deal with. So all the reinforcements you can get, you need. So what are you thinking?
Pitching is the name of the game. That was the Achilles heel of the Mets last year, particularly the bullpen. They went to the final championship series and lost to the team that won it all. But the bullpen needs to be reinforced. Are they going to make a splash and go for someone, a real solid starter? I don't know. You've got Senga coming back. You know, he got injured a lot last year. You don't know. Diaz, you just got to wonder about him. You know, last year it was flip a coin. So I think the bullpen's a critical. It's got to be addressed. How deep are the pockets and how long are the arms of Mr. Cohen, you know, and how far does he want to go? I know that he wants to bring back a winner. And I know that he was totally immersed and excited about being in the postseason last year with his ball club. I think he got a taste of what it's like in postseason and coming that close. And I think he wants to close the deal and bring back a championship to Queens. 39 years coming up now since '86, so it's long overdue. But my attentions would be towards pitching, but particularly the bullpen, because if you're going to put Clay Holmes, make a starter out of him, and he's been a reliever, you can't expect anything more than five innings from him. And that's going to tax the bullpen. I just think I would like to see another starter. We'll see if these new guys they picked up that are kind of rolling the dice, if they come through. Stearns has got a good track record with that kind of acquisition. Which will be a pleasant surprise. But to me, with the way the game is today and the importance of the bullpen because of the lack of the pitchers, the starting pitchers going deep in games, that to me is numero uno.
Well, the rotation's a little scary now, really, because you've got Senga, who health issues, and hopefully he'll be healthy this year, but you don't know. Peterson, who had a great second half when he came back from the hip surgery, but a short blip there. See how that works out. Montas, Holmes, Blackburn, and Canning, who I know pretty much nothing about. That's the rotation right at this point. So it's a little sketchy, I think.
It is. You know, they've got a lot of back end of the rotation guys. I do like Peterson. I always have. And for him to have pitched those years with that bad hip, and remember how wild he was up and away to right-hand hitters, and that was, he's a sinker ball pitcher. He's got to keep the ball down. And last year, he was able to keep the ball down, and I really think he's going to, bar injury, I think he's going to develop into a solid, solid starter, you know. And we'll see about Senga. Manaya's got to do it again, too. You know, you're only as good as your last start. Last season's last season. You know, you knew going in that, you know, and I date myself, you knew you were going to get 20 games out of Marichal. You knew you were going to get 18 games out of Gaylord Perry. You know, 20 games out of Ferguson Jenkins, 15 games out of Rick Wise. You don't have that luxury anymore. It's always, especially the bullpens, a guy has a good year, and my dog is getting crazy here. Calm down.
Come on, McDuff.
He's nuts. He likes the cushions on the pillow. He likes to chew them up. He's a destroyer right now. Anyway, so you don't have that luxury. And so it's kind of rolling the dice. But, you know, this team is very much together. They like each other. That's why Manaya wanted to come back, obviously. He could have commanded more dollars. But like I said, the kind of money he signed for, he's set for life. He likes the environment. He likes the team. The team is close, and that's an important ingredient. That goes beyond the X's and O's and the numbers. I mean, they like each other. They play hard. They pull for each other, and that's a plus. I think Mendoza did a great job as far as changing the culture, and it doesn't happen overnight. And I think that the culture is gradually turning.
You know, is it like 85? Like 85, you know, the team was really good and Doc, you know, emerged and had that incredible year. And 86, you knew this was going to be the year. You guys won 108 games, World Series championship, right, and all of that. You see last year's team at the verge of that, or is it just different with the money and the player flux now that it's kind of hard to predict taking that next step no matter what you do?
Well, what I look at is that I think the Braves have taken a step back. They lost Fried to the Yankees. That's the star pitcher, all-star pitcher. That hurts. The Phillies, were exposed last year. Their bullpen, the back end of their lineup, guys that had good first halves and they were counting on it. You know, water seeks its level. Everybody's got their weaknesses. So I think the Mets are on the rise, and I think the Phillies and the Braves, I've really got to have concerns about the Mets. And we'll see what happens in the offseason with all three of those teams, the moves that they make to improve their ball club.
Yeah, it's certainly not over yet. You mentioned one thing before we let you go. I want to get into that. That they love playing each other, they're having fun. And how much of signing a new player is character? Like, if you look at a player who's a really good character but not a good teammate, a kind of a disruptive force,
right?
Is that enough to just say, we'll pass and get somebody who may not have as much talent but won't cause problems? Do you think that's a factor?
Well, I remember Frank Cashin told me that when they traded for Frank Robinson, he says, we knew what we were getting as far as numbers on the field. He's a great player, MVP in the National League at that point. He said, but what we didn't know was his presence in the clubhouse and how he changed our culture. And one player can do that. And so that's the thing. That's the unknown. And if a player's a good guy, that kind of gets around too. But then there's a lot of guys that they're buttering their own bread. Maybe they're a little false, a false evaluation of them. But I think on this team, everybody is close. You know, McNeil's the only really kind of oddball on that team, but McNeil plays every day. He plays hard. He doesn't handle offers well. He's was much better last year. But you know what he does? When he goes out, he had a tough first half. It does not affect his defense. He runs the ball out. He's a good base runner. He's alert. And that's what I like. Now, if he went out there and sulked with slumps, then, you know, I don't want him on my team. But the fact that he goes out there and he plays his butt off and he plays every day and he's a great defender and a good base runner, he's a guy that's a value to the team.
Okay, well, we're out of time, but Keith, thank you so much for spending Christmas morning with us, and I'm sure all the fans appreciate it.
Merry Christmas to everybody.
Okay, Keith, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Thank you so much. Keith Hernandez should be a Hall of Famer. Hopefully he will be someday, and of course he's on SNY.